Welcome, everybody, to the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast with Coach Chad Timmerman. My name is Jonathan Lee. I'm a certified cycling coach, and I'm the PR director here at Trainer Road. Chad, how you doing today?
Doing well, Jonathan. Thanks.
Good to hear. And we have a special guest with us, CEO and founder of Trainer Road, Nate Pearson. Nate, how you doing?
I'm doing good. About to go on vacation.
Nice, nice. Good to hear. Let's get right into the questions. We've got a number of them coming in this week, or this week we've had a whole list built up. And if you have questions right now, feel free to type them into the questions tab that you have in your GoToWebinar window, and we'll get to those as soon as we can, whatever training or cycling questions you have. First one is from Nate. Nate asks, I have been using Trainer Road and Virtual Power with positive results. My tri bike will be going on the trainer in a few weeks after my last race, and I picked up a power meter to use this off season. Other than pairing the power meter and doing an FTP test, is there anything else I should consider adjusting in my Trainer Road profile before I start building a training plan towards next season? Nate, do you want to take this one?
Sure. This one's less of a coaching question specific to Trainer Road, but in general, if you're going to move from virtual power to a power meter, one thing you're going to want to do is do an FTP test, like Nate said, and then also reset your personal records. That way you can get brand new power records with your power meter. And the last thing is you might consider adding some smoothing to your output. So if you are measuring your power at, let's say, like Garmin Vectors, where it's close to your cleats, or if it's crank-based, your power output will spike and fluctuate a lot more compared to what virtual power is, because it gets naturally smooth, the flywheel weight of the trainer. So you could put a 5-second smoothie on that and kind of have the same result. It'll make you a little bit easier mentally to hit those targets right on.
Great tips. Thanks, Nate. James asks, I want to do the Fred Witten Sportive next year. So 9 months of training, which combinations of training plans would you recommend? The Fred Witten Sportive being a Grand Fondo length Sportive that's over rolling terrain. Chad, for a Grand Fondo style event over rolling terrain with 9 months of training, what combinations of training plans would you recommend?
So James, with 9 months, you've got 36 weeks of training, and there are the combination of our base build and specialty phases will take up right around 28 weeks. I mean, you can extend that a little bit if you choose to go the longer traditional base route and add on the additional weeks, which in your case might actually be a good way to approach it. You're starting this far out, so you've got time to cultivate that deep, wider base. So the traditional base plan might be a better way to go. And like I said, it's 12 weeks, but each of the 3 4-week phases has an option for an additional 2 weeks, making it 16. So you do all three of those, and those are targeted at ultra endurance athletes, which this certainly qualifies. So you do all three of those, that's 18 of them, leaving you safely the other 16 weeks to do probably a sustained build, sustained power build. And then either the century plan, you could even do a rolling road race plan or a sustained road race or sustained climbing road race plan, depending on the format of the sportive you're doing. I'm not sure what the course is like, but even a 40K time trial plan would work. It all also depends if you're planning simply to ride it and finish it, or if you want to be mildly competitive, and that would influence which of those plans you chose.
So which plan would you choose if you wanted to be competitive versus just finish and
competitive?
Enjoy.
That depend on the course topography. So if it's a rolling course, choose the rolling road race. And if you know there are going to be some long sustained climbs, then choose the climbing road race specialty plan.
Now, why would you choose the
Fred Witten?
Is that because you could stay in like a group maybe on some of those climbs and not get dropped to be able to kind of draft some of the flatter spots?
I think the sportives they're supposed to be non-competitive events, but we all know that when we toe the line with a bunch of other athletes, whether it's competitive or not, whether there are prizes or bragging rights, or there's always bragging rights, people will be competitive about it. So if you know that you're one of those people and you want to be with a group of riders and you want to treat it with more of a race approach, one of those road race plans is probably a better fit. If, however, like I said, you're just going to go out there and ride it and enjoy it, the century plan is going to be a better way to go.
Something else to that this talks about, or this gets to like kind of the core of Trainer Road, is when you get into that specialty phase about kind of training with how you're going to ride. So if you know that you want to stay in a group, and usually on rides like this, I've experienced that they'll really nail the hill climbs to kind of like shut off people that aren't going to work on the flats and stuff. So that means depending on the length of the climb, if it's a, you hit a lot of 2 or 5 minute climbs, you're going to need to do a lot of VO2 max intervals, some real short intervals. And then as, if you have a really long climb, like a 40 minute climb, that's going to be more of sustained FTP work, with some punchiness in there, and our workouts prep you for that. But you just, it's just in general, a good coaching tip is you really have to train for what you're going to race for. So if you're going to just go out there and do the same power output for 4, 5, 6 hours, that's how you should train. But if you're going to try to be punchy and stay with a group, then you should train that way.
Yeah, that's a super good point.
Yeah, and this event, the Fred Winton Sportif, it has a little bit of everything with some steep little climbs. So the advice that Nate gave is key. Train for what the course will have for you. Even though it's a longer style event, if you're going to be encountering a lot of those steep climbs, which it looks like there's a number of steep little kicks, for example, Kirkstone Pass and a few others, look at those and prepare for those specific climbs that you'll be going through. I think that with that partnered with the sustained build plan and everything else that you've done prior to that will give you a really solid fitness coming in.
Yeah, and you can always give just a cursory view of the structure of the specialty block that you're considering and see, are there the sort of efforts that I'm going to be doing included in this particular plan? And it might help you narrow it down between, you know, what could be 4 or 5 different decent fits, but the best fit is, again, going to be what most closely emulates the demands of this particular sportif.
And Jonathan also had a good point in there. You don't want to just, go towards what you're going to be racing with, but you don't want to do that for 9 months. You really still have to have that aerobic base and that FTP kind of threshold, raising your FTP in general cycling fitness. And then once you have that real solid base of your cake, you're going to ice it with the VO2 max, doing some of the longer intervals if you're going to be doing more of a century ride, stuff that's going to be specific. So I don't want someone to go in and be like, hey, I'm 9 months out and I'm just going to do hard climbs for, you know, a century ride for an entire 9 months. No, you have to really think of your training over the whole 9 months and make sure that you kind of hit the right zones at the right time.
Absolutely. Scotty asks, or he mentions, I go to the gym, I do leg workouts, core workouts, cardio, etc. While all of that has helped my average speeds in the 60 mile and under distances, everything seems to fall apart after that. I don't have a community here in which to draw wisdom and advice from, so I'm hoping that I can draw from some of yours. When I look at the mid to high volume training plans that you guys have, the base and build plans, my first thought is, where am I going to fit the gym time in there? And then I think, do I really need the gym time? Does he need the gym time, Chad? And if so, how should he fit it in?
Well, Scotty, before we even get to that, the fact that you're petering out at about 60 miles tells me you're lacking in one form of endurance or another, whether it's muscle endurance or aerobic endurance. Both are going to get addressed with a more thorough base approach. So whether or not you choose to do the traditional plan, traditional base, or the sweet spot base, I have a feeling your issue lies apart from weight training, and it's more about cultivating your base fitness. So if you haven't in years past taken your base training very seriously, now's the time to do it. And I'd be willing to bet you're going to see the sort of training response you're looking for. And as far as weights, it's a really contentious issue. I'm an advocate for it with masters athletes, 35 plusers, and female athletes for reasons apart from cycling. When it comes to cycling specifically, I think often there are better ways to spend your time. Structural strength and core conditioning always have a place. As far as weights themselves, it kind of depends. If you insist on doing them, though, and you know you're going to have some higher intensity workouts, I tried a couple of weight training days with high intensity interval days, such that you do your intervals, then you do your weight training, get all your intensity out of the way in that day so that you can recover more thoroughly on your rest days. But trying to do intervals one day, weights the next day, that's just a recipe for overcooking yourself.
Yeah, and two, I think... some people, they see it and they say, hey, I can do a high volume, which is, what's high volume? Five to six workouts a week. And they say, I've been riding 5 to 6 hours a week. But really, we recommend to most people kind of start with the low plan and go through that, which is 3 workouts a week. And then as you figure that you can take the stress, then add more to that. Because again, you don't want to overcook yourself. And also, like, the best way to start a fight on a cycling forum is mentioning weight training. So there's some studies that show that like or CrossFit, that's even worse. That very explosive training can help your efficiency, especially in running. There's one thing that I used to do that has no scientific basis and is an N equals one, meaning I'm the only person in the study, and it could all be in my head. But I don't know, Chad and Jonathan, if you know this, but what I used to do when I would, we have a local race here called the Reno Wheelman, and they'd have a crit series. And the way that I would win the crits is, well, we'll see if it really, correlation causation is not the same thing, but I would go to the gym and I'd squat 135 pounds and I tried to do it 50 or 60 times in a row without taking any break. And I found that the way that I would win a crit was with one or two laps to go, I would break away with, you know, and work for 4 or 5 minutes. So it was a lot of anaerobic work and a lot of VO2 max. And I found that like those, the really, having like 135 pounds on me, I'm a bigger guy. At that time, I was 180 pounds. I'm 6'6". But I would do that so many times in a row, and my legs weren't getting fried at all. It was all in my lungs that would burn, and I'd get that copper taste. So I also had the same experience as when I was stronger. I used to be a weightlifter before I did cycling, and I would peter out after, you know, two hours, 3 hours, and I couldn't do the longer rides. And going back to Chad's point, it was really when I kind of said, okay, I'm going to do this right, and I'm going to start at the beginning and get my base, aerobic base down, and make it so that I'm not struggling just to get through the time. Like I can do the time, and now I can add some intensity here and there and some threshold and make my workout a little more specific than just surviving the distance.
That's what base conditioning is about is, yeah, it's, and that's what that time of the year is for. I mean, we're not trying to do... There's some specifics. We're addressing form and efficiency and things like that. But your primary concern with base training is to cultivate base fitness such that you can actually complete your event. We're not worried about being fast. We're not worried about being particularly powerful at that time. You just want to be able to get through it. And this is even more important when it comes to, you know, long course triathletes and sportive riders and century riders and Grand Fondo. Those guys are going to be on the road for long periods of time. That base becomes exponentially important.
Yeah, I know for myself personally, as a mountain biker, we tend to come across a lot of steep, short climbs, and they come with frequency. And something to keep in mind with weightlifting is the fact that everybody's body is going to react differently. As Nate and Chad have said, the time to test this out and kind of dose your body with some lifting and then check the response is most definitely during the off season of sorts. Learning to, and then building that strength up and then rolling into your training uninterrupted later on is key. So you may react differently to this, but I know that my best season was just this past season, and I did more work in the gym than I have. And I saw those efforts on very short, steep climbs. I was able to carry more speed up and over those climbs. That was a big benefit for me.
And people, one additional thing to consider, if you are going to weight train, if that's simply going to be part of your program, it has to be periodized like anything else. So different times, and I'm not going to get into specifics, but different times of year, different training phases need to be coupled with different types of strength training.
Something too that, Jonathan, you're probably not letting on about how fast you are, but I think you just won the state championship in mountain biking, and your watts per kilogram is right around 5. Is that what you did your race at?
Yeah, just under 5. So
That's
4.86.
That is smoking fast. For those who don't know, Jonathan is...
Yeah, so Jonathan's exceptionally fit. And if that had anything to do with his weight training, well, there's one more advocate on that side of the argument.
And Jonathan also trains like an animal, follows structured plans, does crazy intense rides, and is dedicated his life
to the sport. He's relentlessly consistent.
Yes, that's probably the biggest thing is with all of this stuff that you do, if you're not consistent... You know, consistency is king, right? Like having a little bit less intensity in TSS, so a little bit less training stress on your body, but having it consistent week in, week out, you know, with the periodization and all that kind of stuff is probably first and foremost the thing that somebody needs to do to be
absolutely
successful in cycling.
Most definitely. I mean, you can look at it in terms of, you know, weekend warriors compared with someone like Jonathan. I mean, you can't go out and get all your training in 2 days, no matter how hard it is. It could be the same intensity, the same TSS, same stress, and expect to get faster. Whereas someone like Jonathan, even if he reduced his training load, did less work than this weekend warrior, he's going to see better results because of that consistency.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's certainly not the most appealing or exciting work at times, doing these, building your base for the season coming up. But I personally relish the short and intense efforts that come with mountain biking, crit racing, cyclocross, that type of an event. But I really, really put a lot of time into these long rides where I'm riding at specific power goals and distance for certain durations. And they prove extremely useful as the season goes on. So yeah, great advice all around. Another question that we have is about FTP testing. It says, when doing an FTP test, is there any reason I shouldn't ride out of the saddle for portions? What do you say, Chad?
I'm not a big advocate of getting out of the saddle often unless there's a very specific reason to do so. I don't think many people have the sort of competency to do it efficiently. And it's best saved for those efforts where you actually need to generate more power, or perhaps you just need to stretch. If either of those are the case in your FTP tests, and really only the latter should be, you know, get up and stretch, fine, do 10 pedal strokes out of the saddle or something. But staying out of the saddle and trying to, you know, maybe bump up your power temporarily isn't exactly what a functional threshold test is about. We're trying to look for steady, you know, sustainable power, not power that's influenced by, you know, strength or anaerobic capacity. So use it sparingly if you use it at all.
And Chad, won't that though, I see a lot of people do that too because they get uncomfortable in their saddle, but won't getting out of the saddle kind of make your whole, your FTP actually perform worse? Because you might get a temporary boost, but the aerobic impact, you're probably going a little bit over threshold when you do that. You're actually going
to
hinder it. So you're going to get a lower result than you would if you just stayed in your saddle. And two, if you do get out of the saddle, you know, and you get out and you think, you know, I could have done that test a little bit better. It is okay to, and Chad, back me up here if I'm wrong, raise your FTP a couple watts, you know, 1 to 5 or 2 to 5 watts afterwards, do a few workouts and see if, you know, if that's feeling good. It's after you do, I've done so many tests where I kind of know like, oh, I messed that test up and I went a little bit low here, or I went a little bit too hard. So really my FTP is probably around, you know, 250 instead of 245. And then after I do my first workout or two, then I really dial it in. And I know it's because I'm an experienced rider too, and I've been doing this for a while.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I was just having this discussion with another one of our coaches here, Alex, about how a lot of people underassess. I mean, especially if you're new to it and you don't know how to pace an 8-minute effort, let alone a 20-minute effort. So if for whatever reason you finish and you know you've got a lot of gas left in the tank, you know you could have pushed harder, or maybe something about it, you didn't pace well, and you know you've got greater fitness than that, there's no harm in nudging your threshold up within the app, you know, within your profile, and seeing how the first couple of workouts go.
And Chad, yeah, exactly. Does this type of advice even apply to somebody that's like a single speed rider? For example, if he's a mountain biker, single speed guy, the only way to really get up climbs and the gearing that he has on his bike is to be out of the saddle. Does it vary for him?
I don't think so. I think it's still functional threshold power where you're trying to find your highest sustainable power. If he wants to use a different gear ratio, that's one thing. But getting out of the saddle and recruiting all that extra muscle mass, it's going to have, as Nate pointed out, probably a negative impact, not a positive one. It's really hard to overassess. I mean, your capabilities are what they are, but it's certainly feasible to underassess and do something wrong such that it pulls your number down a little bit.
Yeah, I would say it's impossible to overassess because then you can do it.
Theoretically,
you can do it, you know? Yeah.
Right.
It's too, you shouldn't be able to, if in the last like 30 seconds of your FTP test, you can get out of the saddle and sprint, you did not do a good job of hitting your of going hard enough at the, for the previous 7.5 minutes or 19.5 minutes. You shouldn't be able to sprint at the end. Yeah, you should feel like you're gonna, you know, fall off the bike.
That's a dead giveaway. Anytime we see somebody finish, you can have a mild surge. You know, you start out a little strong, you settle in, you finish a little strong. So you got, you know, a course profile or a ride file that looks like a gentle smile. Anything more extreme than that, you probably started out too hard and or you probably finished too hard. And if you can finish too hard, you didn't go hard enough.
Yeah, that's a good point. Think of all the time trialists that you see at the Grand Tours and everything else. The best time trialists, many times, they cross the line still in the saddle, perhaps for aerodynamic reasons, but also because they have nothing left to give. Getting up out of the saddle and sprinting would be pretty difficult for them at that point.
So I actually I saw a study in the Wattage Forum of this guy did a perfect pacing for like how much power you could put out and how fast you're going and when to put it on the course. And actually, let's say you had like a gallon of gas, like in your body ran out of gas. The best way to do it is to run out of gas like 15, like, or not 15, about 5 seconds before you cross the finish line, meaning that if you were to try to pedal any more for those last 5 seconds, you would pass out. And your momentum carries you over. And
exactly.
Like you said,
so you're
Jonathan,
coasting across the finish line on fumes.
Yeah, because you are just so spent. And you see it in the hill climbs, right? The hill climbs, they don't sprint at the end. They've done that hill climb correctly because they have used all the fitness they can over the course of that climb. You don't see them go up and the guy who, you know, they're going to climb and at the very top, they're like, oh, I'm going to sprint because I had something extra. Like you do in a time trial when you see non-specialist time trials. And a lot of those guys too, they're not trying to win the TT. So, I mean, they just like to sprint for the crowd.
But see, that brings it all back to the original question, and that's, it's a matter of pacing. And if you don't know how to pace, chances are you're gonna underpace it a bit. Most people play it safely rather than blow themselves up. And if they do blow themselves up, they haven't got a usable number anyway. But if they played it safely and they finished, they know they could have done more, give yourself a couple extra watts on your functional threshold, get through those first couple workouts. You'll know when you've reached that point where your number is unreasonably high.
Next question is from Shrey, and he mentions that he just finished a 70.3 this year in July, so good job on that, Shrey. And your next A race is going to be a 140.6 in August, so you're going to be doing a full distance in August, and that'll be of 2016, so next year. It'll be your first one, and you mentioned that our training plans have a base build and specialty, those three phases, which add up to about 28 weeks of total training. Being that you have some time in between now and then, your question is, so what should I do before the 28 to 30 weeks of training begins? Chad, what do you think?
I'll touch on this for sure, because I've got some knowledge on the matter, but I also want to turn this over to Nate, because he's got more actual experience than I do. But when it comes to long events, and a 70.3 certainly qualifies, but especially ultra endurance, where you're stepping up to the full distance, 90%, or maybe I don't even need to put a number on of it, but most of your training needs to target aerobic endurance. It doesn't matter how big your functional threshold is. If you can't get out there and ride the bike for 5 or 6 hours and then get off and run for 3 or 4 hours, you have to have a big aerobic engine. So in your case, you've got an entire year before your event rolls around. I'm not entirely sure you need to, well, it all depends on your level of experience too, but base training is going to comprise most of what you do. So you know, if you need to, or you want to start training right now, the traditional base plans are the way to go. And like I mentioned earlier, each 4 week block, and there's three of them totaling 12 weeks, has an extra 2 weeks that are aimed at ultra endurance athletes. So that right there, there's 18 weeks of your training, and that could help you step back from your event. One more thing, not to complexify this too much, but you can do something like your traditional base, do a build, and then do a triathlon specialty plan building towards a B level event. Take some time off and then do another specialty plan leading up towards your A level event.
So I'm going to tell a story about my first Ironman and what I did, excuse me, incredibly wrong. So I signed up for it, and I signed up a year out, because you have to sign up a year out for all these Ironman races because they fill up so fast. And I think what I did, I think my longest ride before that was like 60 miles. So that first weekend out, I said, I better go hit 100 miles. So I want to prep early. And I went out and did my first 100-mile ride. I did this huge jump in training stress. And then I tried to maintain it. And you know what? I did get a lot more fit, but I was ready to race about 3 months before my race was. And you could actually, I posted in the Slow Twitch forum, you can look back, I think it was 2009, and I have a post in there, and I said, I'm feeling burnt out. I don't want to do the Ironman. This is no fun anymore. I was just so depleted from you know, almost an entire year of incredibly structured and focused training that I wasn't ready. And I had a good result. I think I took my 70.3 time the previous year. I had like a 6 hour one. I was kind of a beginner. And then I took it down to a 455 with like a 226 bike split or 225 bike split or something like that. And so that was about 2 or 3 months before Coeur d'Alene. And then I just fell apart at Coeur d'Alene. And I think someone will look at my time, but it was around 13 hours or some around there. And it just, for my fitness that I had done previously at a half, it wasn't good. And I attribute it to me trying to take on too much too early. And, you know, some people can do that and they can train all year round very structured. But if I was doing that right now and I had that out, I would, you know, I'd backfill, like Chad said, and look for traditional base or sweet spot base, probably traditional base for you since this is your first Ironman. But between now and then, I would just enjoy it. I'd probably go mountain bike a little bit, do some fun video workouts like the Sufferfest, maybe even, you know, maintain my bike fitness and, you know, improve my swimming or running kind of specialty. And then know that when it's time to start that training plan over many weeks, like I am mentally ready for this and I'm not going to burn out. Like I'm telling myself, I gave myself some like mental rest on the bike and now I'm going to come into it and have this stress over time. But two, during that time, you don't want to just get off the bike and be like, oh, I'm not going to bike until 30 weeks before my Ironman. Don't do that. But hopefully I'm getting this point across, is just don't try to like dive in and grab all this fitness really early on. It's like, it's just like in a time trial. You're like, hey, I'm going to go out as hard as I can and buy some time. Like I'm going to buy some time for my arm fitness for my Ironman. So just take it easy and build up slow.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a really good point, actually. I don't know too many athletes. They're a very rare breed who can stay focused for an entire year. Someone who can pick their event, step back 12 months, and then find something meaningful and structured to do all the way up until race day.
Yeah, pros don't do it, right?
Yeah.
Pros take time off.
No, absolutely. They've all got, I mean, they take anywhere from 10 days to 2 months. I mean, it certainly varies. It's certainly varied. But the fact is they get away from it for a little while, and that's necessary both on a physiological level as well as a psychological one, but perhaps more importantly on the psychological level.
In different sports too, like, you know, they don't have year-round seasons in NFL and, you know, NBA and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that's another thing to take in mind. Us as cyclists or endurance athletes, man, there's something we can do year-round. I mean, if we flit even just on the bike, not even taking into account other swimming endurance and running endurance and stuff like that, skiing, we can just stay on the bike year-round and have one race season that folds right into the next one, and potentially no downtime ever.
Yeah, you really have to be diligent on that. I can't stress the importance enough of remembering that professionals don't become professionals simply because they train nonstop. They go about it in a measured way. And just because you're not a professional doesn't mean that, or I should say, it doesn't mean that your path is different to becoming successful, whatever your definition of successful is. The key is going about it in a measured way. And it, as you said, Chad, it's really difficult to keep your focus for 12 months. But trust me, there will be opportunities to perform at an event anytime you want. You just have to look and they're there. So you have to really be diligent in staying focused and disciplined about how you're going to trend your training over the whole year. It's really key.
And how you, that's a good point too, Jonathan, is how you're going to enjoy this. What other races you're going to do that's going to be fun? Are you going to travel to a fun place to go do a training weekend or something like that? Even with Trainer Road, I do all of my TV time is pretty much on the trainer because I have two young kids. So I'm like, I like look forward. Oh, Avengers 2 is going to come out. Okay, I'm going to save that. And I'm going to pair it to this long, you know, 2.5 hour workout that I have. And it's those little mental things that you can do that really like makes me look forward to training. And if you can kind of figure out, you know, throughout your Ironman, what you're going to train for your Ironman, and you can space it out, like I'm going to do this here and this here and this movie comes out here. For me, at least, it's highly motivating and it makes my training so much more enjoyable.
Agreed. There has to be some level of enjoyment. In fact, if you're going to train like most endurance athletes train, there has to be a large level of enjoyment because most of our time is spent training. And kind of along the lines of what Nate just said, I don't have kids, but I love to watch movies and I have a hard time sitting around simply watching a movie. But if I save those better movies for the rides, I know we're going to, you know, the longer, more monotonous rides I'm going to do down in the basement. It's motivating, it's enjoyable, and I get my training done.
My wife and I have a term for that. We call them trainer movies. So like, we go through Netflix and we're like, oh, I'm not going to watch that. That's a trainer movie.
Perfect.
That should be a new category on Netflix. So to recap on this, we have traditional base would probably be the best route for you in the off season if you choose to do that. But also, once again, don't pressure yourself to constantly be training on the bike and constantly be building towards something that could be as much as 12 months away. Remember the fact that you may do better if you're in a better emotional state by taking some time off, or and consequently a better physical state.
Tim, so if you want to do the math on that, let me say one more thing, Trey. If you want to do the math on that, you're looking at 18 weeks plus another 8 and 8. So what is that? 32. That leaves you with at least 4 weeks to play around and enjoy right now.
Yeah. Ironman training is a mental game. That's my last comment on that.
Perfect. Tim asks, well, he's hoping that we could speak a bit on pre and post ride nutrition or meals. Maybe some of our personal routines or favorites as well. I've been really digging into this as of late. The Feed Zone cookbook and the portable cookbook, you can get those on Amazon for a great deal, or local bike shops carry them. They are absolutely fantastic, fantastic books for not just cyclists, but for endurance athletes in general. I have a very sensitive stomach. If I can stomach it, probably myself and a baby, we'd have no problems. And anybody else, of course, would be able to handle it. But I have a very sensitive stomach. And everything within that book that I've tried so far has been extremely effective for me in providing me race fuel that doesn't upset my stomach afterwards. Unlike any type of a goo or any, and not to point out a brand, but any type of those packeted snacks that you can take, or any type of specific, you know, cycling products that you generally see, I'm leaning much more towards making my own. Everything from rice cakes with apple chicken sausage and smoked and some scrambled eggs, some soy sauce, and a little bit of brown sugar. Those are super easy to make, and you can carry them in your jersey pocket and eat those. All the way over to my pre-race nutrition that I always have is steel-cut oats, fresh berries, and honey. And that's generally what I always do. What do you guys think, Chad? What do you usually do for your pre-race and post-ride meals?
I do most of my training in, you know, what's referred to as a fasted state, and that's just a product of the fact that I'm an early riser. So it's hard for me to get any food into my body. For one, my stomach won't tolerate it, and for another, it's not going to be digested by the time I'm on the bike and working. So, but I'm fortunate in that my rides are concentrated. So I get on, I bang out the intensity, usually inside of an hour, and my pre-ride nutrition isn't as important. When it comes to race days, though, and events that take place, or training even that takes place later in the day, you just have to step back and consider, you know, how much digestion time am I going to have? Do I have enough time to digest a high protein and moderate fat meal? Do I need to keep it simple and high glycemic and quick burning so that it gets in there fast, because I'm going to be competing real soon? So the pre-nutrition is really dependent upon a number of things. Post-nutrition or post-workout nutrition is quite a bit easier. And all the talk of late is it's more about nutrient timing than nutrient composition. So it's really about making that 30-minute post-workout window. What you get in there, it's some interesting stuff. I mean, it's gotten pretty lenient, pretty forgiving in terms of what you can take in. With that said, they're not saying that you can literally eat anything and still progress as an athlete. You still have to look at the overall nutritional picture and know that you're getting quality foods, fuel. And but as far as post-workout, it's more about the timing. So nail that 30-minute window. You know, figure out how many grams of carbohydrate, how many grams of protein relative to your body weight you can take on, and do it within that 30-minute window.
I've so on that timing, I've actually seen recent studies where they compare. They say yes, if you do an intense workout and you get you know, some simple carbohydrates in that 30-minute window, and you measure it against another person who takes it later, the glycogen storage is replaced. But they also did
by 24 hours.
They took people. 24 hours, it's the same, right? Or is,
yeah,
is it different?
Yeah, exactly. So I say that the nutrient timing is particularly crucial. Yeah, if you're doing something later that day, or if you need rapid glycogen replenishment for whatever reason. If, however, you're not working out till the next day, Nate's exactly right. There is talk in the forums and by valid researchers and go to sports nutritionists and scientists that say it's not necessarily about timing. So even though I just said all of that, they are showing that as long as you get it in over the course of the next 24 hours, glycogen stores are topped off and you're ready to roll the next day.
My thinking on that is, one, if you're a triathlete and you do more than one workout a day, yes, follow that 30-minute mm-hmm. window. And also, I think a lot of us, I mean, probably all of us, we have jobs and stuff. And I can't, if I used to, when I was single and in college, I could do an intense workout and just watch like Lost on the couch all day long. And that probably doesn't matter and it'll replenish just fine. But if I have to do a workout at, 6 a.m. and then go to work for the rest of the day, I am going to get those quick carbohydrates in that 30-minute window. And hopefully I'll feel better during my workday. So what I do on this, okay, I'm a little weird. So just take that with a grain of salt. My experience is mostly around, triathlon for this. So what I would do is I'll start like before the race and going into it. So the day before the race, especially if I'm traveling somewhere, because we don't have a lot of triathlons in Reno. One thing I'll do is I'll go to lunch and I'll order dinner at the same time that I order lunch. And I'll take that back to wherever I'm staying, especially at like a big Ironman race. Getting dinner the night before an Ironman race can be really, I can like take it out of you. The lines are long. It's usually in these small towns. And it's a great way just to like know that I can eat dinner at 4:30 and go to bed at 8 and have everything set for me. Two, I used to have a really bad like bowel problems on the run on my longer races, like on mile 8 of my half Ironman. That's a 56 mile bike ride, the swim, 56 mile bike ride, and then a half marathon. On mile 8, like I just had to go to the bathroom, and if I didn't find one, I've ruined people's bushes and that kind of stuff. So what I would do, I heard on I was listening to an NPR podcast about the NASA astronauts, and they would, before they'd go on their flight, they'd eat steak and eggs. And they said they would eat steak and eggs, not because it was tasty, which it is, but because it's more bioly readily available. So you can digest more of it without producing waste. The opposite of that is you don't want to eat a salad right before your race, like a high fiber stuff that doesn't always, doesn't digest in your body. So the night before I would do potatoes, which are low fiber, steak and eggs, which is like an awesome meal and a treat in itself. Then the morning of, what I do is I do two like instant oatmeal packs, and I do that because I can take those anywhere I want, and I know that all I need access to is warm water, so I don't have to go to like Starbucks or this special place and get this special meal, that I can just take that with me, and even if I have to camp for a race, I can just warm up some water and put that in. So I'd have that and then some Gatorade, and sometimes I would experiment with a banana. But a key thing I would do also was I would do this, I would have rehearsals. So being on a trainer, I do most of my training on a trainer. I could wake up and kind of time it like exactly what I'm going to do. So if I'm going to do I've done like 3-4 hour, trainer rides, and I'd time it. So I'd wake up and say, okay, if my race starts at 7, I'm going to wake up at 4. I'm going to eat my breakfast. And actually like rehearse my whole nutrition. So then I'd go on the bike and kind of do whatever I wanted on the bike or whatever I was planning on. I right now I like Bonk Breaker bars on the bike for a triathlon, not for road racing, obviously, but for a triathlon, I like that. And then some Honey Stinger, the chewy gels. Those are my favorite right now. And then, so I would do that and then see how I would feel. And I actually up my oatmeal intake because I was kind of feeling a little bit like lightheaded or like I didn't have enough energy later on. And then the other thing I do, which is just the weird part, during the year when I'm kind of early on, I'm not rehearsing stuff, I purposefully eat just crazy stuff on the trainer. Like I'll drink full cups of hot coffee and stuff. It sounds funny, but I want to train myself so that I'm not like Jonathan, like a little baby that's going to spurt up everything. Sorry, Jonathan. I'll eat like donuts, and like that's a treat for me too. That part of the enjoyment. So we'll go get donuts. I'm like, I'm gonna eat that donut after I'm 90 minutes through my interval workout, and just eat, you know, like hamburgers and just real food. And I've found with doing that over the years, I can eat anything on an Ironman course. You know, some people they go, I need. You know, like someone goes, warm chicken broth, warm chicken broth. I have to have warm chicken broth. If I don't have that, my race is over. I'll just eat whatever. And it's pretty nice.
Well, see, in Nate's case, that may have cultivated a... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in Nate's case, that may have cultivated an iron stomach. And that's how it worked out for him. I can say for sure that's not how it would work out for me. But at least I would figure out which foods were tolerable and which weren't.
Yeah, and the trainer is a perfect environment to narrow that down because of the fact that you can control other variables, right? And one thing, a common thread across what all of us have mentioned is the fact that making sure that you simulate your events timing that you're training for is key and how you will have to feed yourself for those events. I personally, and once again, as Nate referenced, I have a baby stomach, but I carry a rice cooker with me, and I know that sounds crazy, but I bring my rice cooker with me if I'm traveling to an event. And this was much more brought to home this year. I was traveling down and I was racing one of the USAC events the US Cup mountain bike races down in LA. And I had a meal from a restaurant that I thought I trusted and knew, and it's a meal that I've had plenty of times, and I got food poisoning the next day. And that was race day. So there's certain things that you need to do that you can do with the trainer to be able to test and control things. And like Nate said, if you can, by any means, get your dinner or get your recovery meal or whatever meal following your training or your event, if you can get that meal in advance and make sure that you have it there so that you don't have to wait for it and go through any unexpected events prior to, that is a wonderful advice that can be extremely beneficial. Mitchell, you mentioned that you have, this one's going to, you provide quite a lot of information here. You mentioned the fact that you have a pretty high ratio based off of your weight. You're at 4.98, so kudos, Mitchell. You're a strong rider. On the other side of that, my short power is not so awesome. I'd like to improve upon this in the next season while still growing my FTP. After my base period, would you recommend a short power build for me? Or some blend of sustained and short power build. As at this point, my FTP increases are hard earned. As an add-on to this, currently my only power data source is a kicker, and I would like to quantify just how bad my short power is so that I can quantify the improvements, which is a big motivator for me. You're currently using the high volume 40K TT plan, especially block targeting a 100-mile gravel race over rolling terrain on October 31st in anticipation of it being mostly an extended TT-style effort. So, Chad, we've got an athlete that's preparing for a 100-mile gravel race, so day in the
actually,
saddle.
Mitchell, you've got probably five different good questions here, all valuable. So let's just tick through them. The first one, so your FTP is already high. And you're talking about having a hard time growing your FTP, and based on and you're a reasonably light rider, but you're not bantam weight, so that's a really respectable FTP. Problem is, you may have actually approached your genetic potential. Who knows? But either way, you've pushed yourself up way towards that ceiling, and you're not going to see, very probably aren't going to see, improvements in your muscle endurance and your FTP without probably shifting focus for a little while to VO2 max work. Try to create a little more space to elevate your FTP. But right now, the two are too close together. So without getting too sciencey or coachy, your VO2 max is what it is. I mean, then threshold comes at different percentages of that. How far you can push your threshold up towards your VO2 max, it sounds like you may be real close to that. So now you got to push your VO2 max up a little more. So some work on your short power is absolutely in line. Sounds like you have a good handle on that. The short power build is a good way to go about it too. And there's enough muscle endurance work in there that you're not gonna lose any of that over the course of this. The 40K TT block for the event you're targeting is also a good choice. You're looking for sustained power. I mean, if that's in fact a extended TT style effort, then you're on the right track there. So, but for now, I guess now, when you get to your build training, the short power is absolutely the way to go.
Tim asks, while in a TR training plan, should I incorporate my upper body weight workouts on the same days as when I ride and have my rest days be true rest days, or would it be better to do my upper body training on the days I don't ride? All while understanding that I do need days off the bike and off other exercising activities. So,
yeah, so Tim, we actually addressed that earlier, and that's exactly your first suggestion is the way to go. Your rest has to be real rest. Otherwise, you're just getting a little more tired. And even if you stay on that such that you're not dead tired at the end of each workout, you're not ever really getting any true rest, as you put it. So absolutely, group those together, see how that goes. And like I mentioned earlier, if you do weight training, it has to be periodized in much the same way that your cycling training does. So see to it that the combination, even if it is just on a single day, doesn't become overwhelming to the point where a day of true rest should see you ready to roll again. If it doesn't, well, that combination might still be a little much.
Two, the having the true rest days is it's about mental, right? Like so much in endurance sports is about the mental edge of it. And I think in general, people that participate in endurance sports are more mentally tough than the general public, because you say the things that you do and people just go, I can't believe it, and they have problems working out 20 minutes twice a week. That's very easy. So having those like complete rest days where one day say, okay, this is my workout day and I'm gonna work hard, and then Tuesday or Wednesday, that's gonna be a rest day. I'm going to, my job that day is to rest and recover, and my body's gonna get stronger that day. And having that mindset and that mental, like it's a mental energy too, to be able to let yourself like rest and get more fit. Cause as we all know, you get more fit on the rest days. You get more fit when you recover and you rest, not during the actual workout. The workout tears your body down. Rest is what builds it back up. So again, just having that rest day is key to not only physiological, but also psychological.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That I think too many athletes don't give due credit to how much discipline it takes to rest well. Especially if you're a multi-sport athlete or just in general an overachiever, a type A personality, you feel like you should always be doing something. And sitting on the couch with your legs up, eating blueberries, doesn't really constitute doing something for most of us. So there has to be a bit of a kind of a mental shift in how you approach your recovery. It has to be legitimate. When you head into that next workout, you should feel ready for that next workout.
One thing too that I'm getting into now, which is a little bit off topic, but is really trying to optimize the hours that I'm sleeping, which we don't talk about it enough in the endurance world. It's all about train, power, but sleep is the most important thing, right? If you don't have sleep, nothing's going to work. And a couple things that I've been doing recently, we have a fan in our bedroom, which helps being nice and cool. Cause sometimes if I work out too hard, I'll kind of get hot in the sheets. And then I also wear a sleep mask now. There's studies that show that even the glow of your alarm clock can mess with your melatonin levels. So I wear this sleep mask and I kind of sleep with my eyes open. So I've been putting in this, it's like this petroleum jelly gel that you put in your eye, and don't do it with regular petroleum jelly. It's a one specific for eyes. You can look it up it's a Refresh Plus is the brand. I put that in, I put the mask on, and then I try to limit my computer screen time at night, because that can also, the blue light from that can mess with your melatonin levels. I actually bought these supposed blue light blocking glasses, but they were horrible and I don't recommend them. But it's just like, if you think about rest and saying, hey, I'm optimizing, a lot of you guys are TR members, I'm optimizing my training. Now, what if I optimize my rest too? I tell people the only difference between how a pro trains and like an age group athlete trains is that a pro can handle more stress. And part of that is they just might naturally be better sleepers than you. They have other genetic things, but that's a key point that I think a lot of people miss and forget. And Jonathan always tells a story of Sky. They look at the types of pillow their athletes have. What kind of sheets do they have? They had that bust to try to improve. They got kicked out for not Froome, but tell me, Jonathan, what was his name again?
Yeah,
I'm blanking on his name. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for Port. Yeah, they had a a special bus so he didn't have to sleep in the hotels that might be loud or too hot or a bad bed. But sleep's so important. That just goes to the point of having a true rest day and then just make your sleep awesome and no caffeine at night. I'm probably beating a dead horse here, but I think you guys get the point, is focusing on your sleep can really improve your fitness.
Yeah, and while I don't have any, you know, science or data or research to back this up, I would venture to guess that sleep could be arguably more important than nutrition, and it's restorative. So you can call it recovery, you can call it regeneration, you can call it restoration. It's all the same thing. If you don't emerge from it a little stronger than you were, ready to face the next challenges, something is insufficient. If it's not your nutrition, it could very well be your sleep. And I'm in the same boat as Nate. I try to weed out as much sensory input as possible before I go to bed. You know, no blue light, lights are low, no loud sounds. If I'm watching TV from afar, the TV's turned down. I have a sleep mask, I have earplugs, I have a cool bedroom, because over the years, I've learned how very important the quality of my sleep is to my training.
David asks, or he mentions that when I'm going hard, I find I naturally tend toward around 100 to 103 RPM cadence. So I've been trying to stick to that. But then I'm left feeling maybe in between gears on the cassette. Perhaps I should let my cadence down into the low mid 90s to find the right power while testing, especially as I'm ultimately training for cyclocross and probably don't want to train myself into too high a normal cadence. This is a common question that a lot of people have, just what cadence should they be riding at? And there are certain suggestions, there's certain windows like the normal 85 to 95 RPM. But Chad, are there any catch-alls, or are there any perhaps anecdotes that you could share that could be of value here?
Well, the first thing I notice is this guy's a cyclocross racer and he's talking about being caught in a too high of a normal cadence. I'm not entirely sure that applies to cyclocross, because the courses are so ever-changing. I think cultivating a quicker spin is going to serve him better than a more powerful muscular mashing one. And as far as what cadence suits you, if that's the one that you gravitate towards and it seems to keep your perceived exertion low, your heart rate low relative to your power output, then I wouldn't knock it. The people I'm concerned with are the people who spin excessively slow and overstress their quads in particular.
I think one point to add to this is, since you are a cyclocross racer, you'll be riding over varied terrain, whether that be grass, dirt, whatever it may be. As a result, since the terrain is going to be inconsistent and bumpy, if you can sustain sufficient control over your bike and your pedal stroke at that cadence of 100 and 103 RPM, then that's good. But that should be one of the priorities, or perhaps a better set, an indication of proper cadence for you, keeping in mind that you can train yourself to operate more efficiently at certain cadence ranges. But if you find that when you're riding at 100 to 103, that you tend to not be able to absorb the bumps and kind of hover with your butt off the seat like you need to, then that should be an indication that you need to reassess where you're riding at with your cadence. What Chad said in the beginning too was very key. Cyclocross, perhaps more than any other discipline, sees a very wide range of cadence within a short amount of time, from very steep ledges and going through sand to something downhill or something where you're spinning extremely quickly. So, Chad, did you have anything else to add on to that?
Just something we've already touched on several times, and that your training has to be specific to your events. So, and with cyclocross in particular, I see a wide range of cadence. You know, if you're grinding through mud, you're probably going to want a slower gear and a stronger grind. But you also don't want to be stuck at the base of something you might actually be able to ride up in too big of a gear. So in your case, a wide range of cadences is an excellent approach, a necessary one.
Yeah, so to directly answer your question, don't be afraid of letting your cadence drop into the low to mid 90s like you say there. If you're finding that you're going to be getting training benefits for the event that you're training for, that's what you should be doing.
Yeah, give it a shot. Worst case, you find it doesn't really work for you and you're better off with that quicker 100 plus spin. But why not at least give it a shot?
John, I think this is going to be the last question from John. If you do have any more questions, send them in quickly and we can get to them. John asks about setting the training ranges question. He says, I use a 5-minute VO2 max effort, and after a 10-minute recovery, you do a 20-minute TT. So I assume that this is to assess your VO2 max. So to do VO2 max training, 3 to 5 minute intervals, should that be done at 95% of the 5 minute effort? And for lactate threshold, should that be done at 105% of the 20 minute test? Your intervals run 10 to 15 minutes for that. Chad, what do you think?
Not entirely sure. VO2 max. So we base all of our power levels off of your functional threshold power that we get either from an 8 minute or a 20 minute. And the 8 minute is pretty close to what you get for a 5 minute test. So help me out here, you guys. I'm not entirely sure.
I think he's talking about the 20 minute FTP test, because setting the training range is question. So, and that's how the 20 minute test is set up, is a 5 minute VO2 max effort, and then followed by a 20 minute TT. So I think so this is a common question with Trainer Road, and we have plans actually to kind of make this a little more clear. The workout text shows this, but during the 5 minute period before your 20 minute text, you should just go all out during that period. It's going to wipe away all your anaerobic work capacity, because we don't want that interfering with your 20 minute TT test. So instead of like trying to be done at a certain percentage, just make that 5 minutes as hard as you can. And then you rest. And then when you do your 20 minute TT test, if the question is related to FTP, it should just be an all out effort over the whole thing. I think if you hit 102%, that's going to be probably equal to what your existing FTP is. But you can also, you should just go as hard as you can. I think that's what the question is, John, if you have any other.
That's what he's after. A lot of people they get confused by the fact that there's, you know, recommendations, maybe a target power and then a line some of it gets confusing. All that stuff's basically just disregard it and go as hard as you can. And I know a lot of people, myself included, are tempted to hold back on that 5 minute effort, thinking, oh, I don't want to waste my energy for the upcoming 20 minute effort. But really, like Nate mentioned, we're trying to do something very specific there. I mean, one, you can learn roughly where your power at VO2 max falls. But more importantly, we're trying to build off, or we're trying to burn off some of the energy contribution that comes from something we're not exactly trying to measure. So gut yourself during that 5 minutes, recover, and then gut yourself during that 20 minutes.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. Test. And it is a hard test. And just remember the fact that the power is such an objective form of measurement. Many times people tend to focus on VO2 max and power and end up kind of following a two-pronged approach to how they should structure their training. Chad earlier mentioned the fact that your VO2 max is your VO2 max. While there can be changes in it, it certainly isn't as trainable as something like your power on when we're talking about these shorter durations. Rely heavily on power measurement and structuring your training based off of your power zones. You'll see greater benefits from that than trying to combine two different metrics and measuring from different protocols. If you stick with one protocol and trust in what you have with your FTP tests, you'll see better results. So
yeah, that's one thing too. Just Chad, you can kind of comment on this. This is a common point of confusion that I hear with people. People say, hey, your VO2 max, like your VO2 max score doesn't really change unless you gain a lot of weight. It might change a little bit, but your power at VO2 max is trainable and that can change. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's
is that a good way to put it?
That's basically it. Genetics kind of sets your upper aerobic capacity limit, your VO2 max. And it's trainable to some extent, especially if you're really deconditioned. You can see, measurable improvements in VO2 max, but for most of us who are already pretty well conditioned, VO2 max isn't going to change much. In some cases, it might not change at all. It's just not nearly as highly trainable as functional threshold power, or really any duration relative to it. So if you consider VO2 max your ceiling, your aerobic ceiling, everything else can be pushed up toward that ceiling. So everything else is trainable, functional threshold power especially. And you can narrow that gap. So say you do a step test and you find out your peak aerobic power is 400 watts and your threshold is 300. You're only 75% of the way there. You've got a lot of room to grow. And you can bring that threshold up 320, 30, 40, 50 and push yourself up 85 90, 92, 93% of the way towards your VO2 max. And VO2 max hasn't changed, but your power and you as an athlete and a performer has changed vastly.
And James, or John, forgive me, John added on, he appended a portion to this question. You asked, then what FTP percentage should I do short efforts at? James, that, yeah, so that, or John, forgive me.
That's a good question. Ahead, so yeah, if you're brand new to Trainer Road and you have no clue what your FTP is, we recommend setting it, you know, if you're a well-trained guy, depending on your weight, around 200 or 150. And if you're a woman, you know, as low as, and you're new to cycling, 80, 70, somewhere around there. But John, if you're going to repeat this test more than once, just come into that, like the warm-up, at what your FTP is. So that workout is designed for all the other intervals and like the short bursts to be done, that warm-up part, be done at your existing FTP. And then during the test periods, the VO2 max anaerobic work capacity scrubbing and the 20-minute test, those are both meant to be all-out efforts, but the rest of that, the recoveries, are geared, designed to be at your current FTP. And you know, we've talked about kind of ways to guess people's FTP as they first join Trainer Road. I think maybe our long-term, don't quote me on this, but we might do a ramp test to kind of estimate someone's FTP so that they can then do that warm-up at the correct FTP, and then the test will either validate the ramp test or just lock them better into what their actual FTP is. But we struggle with that because we don't know if, you know, we just had somebody here who's new to cycling and her FTP was 105, or, you know, you get some people and they've been training for a long time, they don't know their FTP and their FTP is 300. So being able to lock that in at the beginning is difficult. But John, if you're doing this test more than once, just use whatever your FTP was from, you know, of what your current FTP is and follow the workout, except for the test periods where you should be going all out.
Yeah, and just one thing also that I would add to that, going forward, one of the benefits, at least with Trainer Road, John, is the fact that once you do assess your FTP accurately, and I don't know if this question is extending, it seems as if you're asking specifically about FTP testing, but if it does in fact involve something beyond that, and into the subsequent training that follows, I would echo what Chad and Nate have said in the sense that you should train for whatever event you will be doing. So as far as what FTP percentage should you do the short efforts at, if that is in fact pertaining to training afterwards, that should all depend on the type of efforts you'll be doing on race day. So perfect. Thank you for showing up to the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast. We appreciate all of your questions, and we'll be doing these occasionally throughout the coming months here. So feel free to come back, bring more questions, bring other people, and we'll be happy to take your questions. Thanks for joining, everybody.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.